Well, gentlemen, ladies, I'm expected to introduce a conference on liberalism. This is not an easy task, rather a tall order, for at least two reasons. First, I am aware that discussion is afoot among American thinkers, mainly in the Catholic tradition, about the legitimacy of the conception of freedom that underlies the foundation of this country. But I'm afraid that for reasons of time and place, I could not access the main documents of this controversy. Therefore, I will leave it aside, at least for the time being. Second, the very word liberalism is so dreadfully ambiguous that its use is misleading as long as we don't come clean about the meaning in which we take it in a definite context. I therefore chose to ponder a while on the very notion of freedom. This provides me with an opportunity to come back to a meditation on freedom, of which the present talk will constitute the third part. The first two parts I wrote in some sort of English. The first lecture was published in a collective work on Christianity and freedom 2 years ago. The second one will see the light of day in a book of mine by the title of Curing Mad Truths, scheduled to be published this fall. Let me very briefly summarize the results I claim to have obtained up to now. In the first essay, I endeavored to show that the idea of freedom strikes its roots not only in the Greek tradition, let us say in shorthand Athens, but in the biblical tradition in Jerusalem. It does that not so much at the social and political level, but rather at the highest point that we can possibly imagine, or the roots are above, i.e. in the relationship between God and his creatures. The biblical God is the one who sets free his people from the Egyptian bondage and introduces it into an ethics of freedom. The alleged Ten Commandments of the Decalogue are in fact meant to preserve the freedom of the newly liberated people from the temptation of falling back into slavery. In the second essay, I endeavored to supplement the first widening of perspective, which is historical in nature, with a second broadening, more philosophical. I try to replace human liberty in the wider context of freedom, such as it stems from the inferior levels of being, winds its way through plants and animals, and reaches its peak in the way in which man can choose his personal way of life and organize his being together with his fellow human beings. Those two previous attempts have in common an attempt at breaking out of a narrow conception of Western intellectual history in which we are commonly caught. This narrow, or rather short-sighted view of liberty supposes that it arose out of the blue in modern times, more precisely in the Age of Enlightenment. This legend is especially rampant in my native country, in which the Enlightenment is interpreted backwards as leading to the French Revolution. The latter is still seen in the rosy light of our Third Republic, which saddled the late 19th and the early 20th centuries before it collapsed with the defeat of 1940. It wanted to do away with the last traces of the Ancien Régime and had to write its own genealogy in order to legitimate itself. Now, my point will consist in showing that modern times brought about a break in the idea of freedom so that the traditional view is partly correct in its claim that modern times introduce something new. I will sort of take up the basic idea of Benjamin Constant's famous essay, A Comparison Between Ancient and Modern Liberty, let's say Greek liberty and French liberty, but in quite a different key. For the third step in my meditation, which is the present talk. I'd like first to take my bearings from a sentence in St. Paul's epistle to the Galatians, the one I chose as the title of this lecture, i.e. Christ has made us free for freedom. Well, I must apologize. I should have thought earlier of saying the organizers of this conference that I was about to bring a handout. But thanks to modern technology, you have a visible and readable version of this handout. I wish I had been able to have it Xeroxed, but okay. Never mind. Well, as far as this quotation by St. Paul is concerned, I know full well that I am passing the sentence in a way that is not the only possible one. But I chose it for obvious reasons. And by the way, this is the way in which the well-known Bible of Jerusalem Bible, made by the Dominican fathers of the École Biblique in Jerusalem, chose to translate the sentence. Curiously, by the way, I realized after a somewhat perfunctory perusal of some indexes that this passage seldom was quoted by important Christian thinkers for some reason. But I can leave aside the context for the time being and concentrate on the core meaning of this short utterance. Christ had set us free so that we'll be free. Freedom is the end result of a process of liberation wrought by the sacrificial death of Christ. This process has no other, no higher goal than freedom. Hence, freedom is something like an end in itself. Now, I'm sure you're beginning to fidget. This idea sounds resolutely modern. And as a matter of fact, it was taken up implicitly in further thought, and especially in modern times. I found three authors who, all of them, transfer it from the moral to the political, hence prefer to the Saxon word freedom the Latin name of liberty. There is first, in the 17th century, Spinoza, who writes in the last chapter of his political-theological treatise, what you can read here, the true goal of the Commonwealth is liberty. He means thereby that every citizen should be free from fear and live as securely as possible, i.e., that he should keep his natural right to existence and action. The goal of common life is not to make out of rational beings animals or robots. Well, he doesn't say robots, he says machines. But the unhampered functioning of his body and mind. One century later, we read the following sentence under the pen of David Hume: liberty is the perfection of civil society, but still authority must be acknowledged essential to its very existence. The Scottish philosopher takes over Aristotle's distinction between zen, existence, life, and erzen, good life. Authority is inescapable if a civil society, if any civil society whatsoever, is to exist. But a good civil society, a society that really deserves the epithet of civil and even of civilized, must have liberty as its highest goal. One more century later, Lord Acton wrote, "Liberty is not a means to a higher political end. It is itself the highest political end. It is not for the sake of a good public administration that it is required, but for the security in the pursuit of the highest objects of civil society and of private life." Well, those three thinkers, the excommunicated Jew, the lapsed Presbyterian, and the devout Catholic, share a view of reality that could aptly be described as liberal. And as a matter of fact, all three are commonly considered as belonging to the gallery of ancestors of what we call at present by the name of liberalism, the very notion that is at the heart of the present meeting. But could even add that the ending syllable ism is especially apposite in this case, since it commonly expresses the ideological character of a thought that gives pride of place to a phenomenon and extols it so as to make it ultimate, like hedonism, okay, pleasure as the highest thing, materialism, matter as the core of being, humanism, and so on and so forth. The trouble with liberalism is not liberty as such. It is the suffix ism, which suggests that liberty is taken as a name in itself. Shall we then have to admit that liberalism is present in St. Paul? Shall we make of the apostle one of the founding fathers of modern liberalism? And first of all, shall we have to put the three formulas I have quoted on the same level? In order to drive to drive a wedge between them, let me take advantage of an author who is seldom quoted in the context of a discussion of freedom, i.e. Plotinus, the Greek Neoplatonic. Well, Neoplatonism is a concept that was coined in the 19th century, the great Platonic philosopher of the 3rd century of our era, Plotinus. I will take advantage of his treatise on the free will and will of the one. This is the last but one of the 6th and last Aeneid, hence of the whole work according to the edition by his disciple Porphyry. This is a work of Plotinus's mature years, among the loftiest peaks of his metaphysical thought, so that one easily feels dizzy. Yet I will pick out of this awe-inspiring treatise a very basic, not to say humdrum, idea. Writes Plotinus, since one seeks freedom and being in one's own power for the sake of the good, freedom is for the sake of the good. As a matter of course, and this is why I left the small word since at the beginning, this statement of capital relevance occurs in a subordinate clause. This is most frequently, not to say almost always, the case for the deepest presuppositions of a thinker, for what he takes for granted. For such statements look so evident to his own eyes that making them sounds like pedantically belaboring the obvious, as if he, begged for pardon, having to say so evident a thing. Well, let me first emphasize that a concept of freedom seldom occurs in Greek philosophical thought. For the word eleutheria, which we translate by freedom, means first and foremost a social and political phenomenon. It was the condition of the free people who enjoy the rights of citizenship in contradistinction to douleia, slavery. Freedom as qualifying human action and the action of each and every human person occurs mainly in Augustine, who, by the way, is very much in the wake of St. Paul on this point in particular. But this use has some anticipations precisely in Plotinus. Plotinus, who says somewhere else, for example, that the bad person is not only the passive result of what has made him who he is, but has in himself another free principle, arche alle eleutheria, a principle that makes him responsible for what he or she does. What is important for my purpose is that Plotinus conceives of freedom as being freedom for the good. This was self-evident for ancient thought. But this seldom was explicitly formulated. Interestingly, there is a case in which this view is implicit and it belongs to the realm of natural phenomena. What we call free fall, before you open the parachute. What we call free fall was also for the good, according to ancient physics. Bodies were supposed to endeavor to reach their natural place because this was where they fully were, where they had to be. This was the place of their good. Aristotle is clear about this. If a stone falls down, it's in order to get to the center of the earth, or as near as possible to the center of the earth, because this is the natural place of heavy bodies, the place in which bodies, heavy bodies, are really what they are, hence the place in which they meet their good. Now, we have just seen that utterances according to which freedom is an aim in itself crop up in modern times. Moreover, the echo is sentenced by St. Paul. Yet, there is a huge gap between two sets of formulas that at first blush look synonymous. Plotinus' observation can help us to distinguish and qualify. If we bring Plotinus' simple idea to bear on our three formulas, we get a paradoxical result. Namely, the most recent sentence by Lord Acton stems from a conception of freedom that is in fact older than the first two. The difference being that for the two earlier ones, Spinoza and David Hume, there is no good. Whereas Acton meant free access to the good. We can elicit this idea from the famous passage in which Acton characterizes what he calls the Catholic notion of liberty in contradistinction to what he calls the political notions of the modern world. According to Lord Acton, the Catholic notion defines liberty not as the power of doing what we like, but the right of being able to do what we ought. This implies that we are free for us to be able to do our duty, i.e., to look for the good. On the other hand, the earlier exponents of the same idea, or rather of an idea that sounds like it, but is in fact at loggerheads with it, have dropped the idea of the good. The best example might be Spinoza. The Dutch philosopher is very much in the wake of Thomas Hobbes, according to whom there is no such a thing as a supreme good. This is the... There is no such finis ultimus, utmost aim, nor summum bonum, greatest good, as is spoken of in the books of the old moral philosophers. An incredibly cheeky utterance. Good and evil are names only. All these words of good, evil, and contemptible are ever used with relation to the person that uses them. There being nothing simply and absolutely so, nor any common rule of good and evil to be taken from the nature of the objects themselves. Good and evil are names that signify our appetites and aversions. Therefore, Spinoza, too, what we call good is nothing short of what we desire. And desire looks for conservation. Interestingly, the object of desire of conservation, is plain being. being tout court, being shorn of its striving for better being. Oh, that's the quotation by Spinoza. We don't look for what is good because we consider it is good, but on the other hand, we sort of bestow a value on the things because we desire them. Spinoza, probably with a full consciousness of what he is doing, reverses a well-known sentence by Aristotle in Metaphysics Lambda. This boils down to reducing whatever is done by living beings, and in particular by intelligent beings, to desire, will, striving. Will becomes kind of an ontological principle. This notion holds sway over modern thought as a whole, a notion that comes to the fore with various levels of clarity in many thinkers. So Schelling, Schopenhauer with his will, Darwin, Nietzsche's will to power, Bergson's élan vital, and so on and so forth. Let me observe here, en passant, that the real nature of desire, of the striving towards existence and the fullness of it, what we call at present self-fulfillment in the case of human beings, that exists in each and every living being, well, the nature of this desire is an enigma and has remained so for modern thought since its inception. How is it that the living individual strives after its own conservation? What is the driving force of evolution? More often than not, those questions are simply brushed under the carpet. Be that as it may, we are now in possession of a criterion, either good or no idea of the good. Be that as it may, wherever the good is absent, the idea of freedom takes another meaning. This meaning is, so my thesis, at the root of what we call at present by the name of liberalism. Freedom as a property of the human mind and liberty as a quality of political institutions are either good or bad, depending on whether they take account of the good or not. This sounds like a tautology, is a tautology indeed, and has to be a tautology. For the judgment is passed by freedom itself, whether it decides to look for the good or to shift for itself. Now, more often than not liberty, but liberation becomes a goal in itself. A well-known sentence is repeatedly ascribed to Fichte. Being free is nothing. Becoming free is heavens. Well, that's not by Fichte, but by almost forgotten German playwright, Ernst Raupach. Well, I wasn't aware of the very existence of the fellow, but I simply Googled the formula and discovered, to my greatest amazement, that the poor Fichte was totally innocent of the formula, which should be let on the mat of this Raupach. Be that as it may, the formula captures the gist of modern freedom, together with a predicament that comes along with it. I had my first position as a university lecturer too many years ago at the so-called Université de Bourgogne, University of Burgundy. I taught there for 2 years before coming to Paris. The university is located in the former capital city of Burgundy, Dijon. While having a stroll in this beautiful city, I realized that the main east-west oriented street, most probably the former Decumanus Maximus of the Roman camp, is called Rue de la Liberté, Liberty Street. Now, it leads to the Place de la Libération, Liberation Square. I was surprised when I got cognizant of what sounded like a paradox. I was expecting the other way. You know, a street is a place where one walks or drives. A square is a place in which one rests or parks. Hence, I was expecting that liberation should logically lead to freedom, to liberty. The active process of getting free, leading to the recovery of a formerly lost freedom, now peaceably and thankfully enjoyed. Now, the people who gave the streets and squares their names, for some reason, did the contrary. As a matter of fact, this is a parable of sorts that concretely and ironically mirrors the modern conception of freedom. Freedom is understood as leading to liberation, not the other way around. One can express the nature of a present predicament in more philosophically dignified terms as a remarkable and paradoxical reversal of the relationship between dynamis and energeia, such as those concepts were defined ages ago by Aristotle. Let us have a quick look at a famous characterization of life given by Thomas Hobbes. It is, according to the English philosopher, a perpetual and restless desire of power after power that ceaseth only in death. Aristotle would have rubbed his eyes, raised his hand, and said, well, of course, Mr. Hobbes, you mean desire for ever greater fulfillment, desire for what I call energeia, certainly not for what I call dynamis. To our ears, the formula desire for power sounds understandable. We prefer power to the lack of it, potency to impotence. Yes, if we look at Hobbes' formula more carefully, it is extremely weird, since power is a capability of doing, hence a mere possibility, not any positive achievement in itself. It would be apposite to look for the deeper reasons that led modern thought to admit this reversal of the relationship between dynamis and energeia. They made possible our present understanding of what we call energy. Well, that's funny, by the way, we speak of electric energy and even, which is more preposterous, of potential energy. Aristotle would have laughed, would have guffawed in front of such a formula. This made possible our present understanding of what we call energy, and first the users of energy and related words in some Renaissance thinkers, since till the strange equation that we find in the astronomer Johannes Kepler, who writes without qualms of conscience, vis seu energia, okay, which would be translated back into Greek, dynamis is energeia, which is, well, contradictory. But this is another story. Well, in any case, we are indulging at present in some sort of freedom fad. We have been looking, since the inception of modern times and still more in recent decades, we have been looking for ever new areas of liberation, ever new rights, for new categories of beings that could be set free. We keep discovering ever new areas of slavery. We expose them and claim new liberation in an indefinitely open process. Domination becomes the key theme of the many incarnations of Johnny One Note in contemporary social theory. Women are enslaved by males. Gay people are enslaved by straight ones. Animal species are the slaves of human beings. the whole earth is enslaved by human greed, and so on and so forth. I could even suggest for future thinkers, what is false is oppressed by what is true. Non-being is oppressed by being. We should go beyond the revolt against, for instance, speciesism, and coin the category, the negative category, of beingism. Beingism, giving preference to what is over what is not, which is an intolerable discrimination. The snag is that probably as a compensation, modern liberty has as its consequence a multiplication of regulations of all kind. Since early modern times, and at a pace that keeps quickening, the state has been enforcing upon its citizens new duties. Having people pay taxes and contribute to the maintenance of its apparatus, of the state apparatus, is a necessary feature of the state. Hence, it is as old as the ancient world. But the duties of schooling and the duty of military service for everybody valid citizen are new phenomena that came to the fore in the 19th century. This was seen right after the apparent triumph of liberty in the French Revolution. This was seen by a bevy of thinkers of the early 19th century. The earliest ones might have been in the Netherlands, the poet Isaac da Costa, a Jewish convert to Calvinism, who in a pamphlet published in 1823 protested against the liberalism in the name of freedom. And some years later, in France, Tocqueville, on the example of the United States, observed that a free, democratic society can become a society in which social pressure exerts a soft but overwhelming crush on its members. The chapter is so famous that I hardly need to quote it. External, visible constraint is less dangerous than another kind of it, internal and more insidious. What most people call at present freedom is desperately narrow, limited by the very fact that it concerns the individual only. An individual who, moreover, is the slave of his or her own desires. We need, on this point, to give an ear to Kant's, German philosopher Immanuel Kant, to Kant's stern doctrine about freedom. As long as we yield to our desires, we are in what he calls a pathological situation. We are passive and don't act really. We are acted, sort of. We are not free subjects, but if I may play on words, subject to another power. Hence, it is apposite that we should ask a couple of questions about modern freedom, freedom such as it is understood by what we call at present by the name of liberalism, i.e., freedom for what? Freedom from what? As for the question freedom for what, we can take over the question ascribed to Lenin and explicitly stated in an essay by the French novelist Georges Bernanos, La liberté pour quoi faire? Freedom what for? T.S. Eliot says something deep in his critique of what he calls, that's his word, liberalism. Liberalism is not... Liberalism is something which tends to release energy rather than accumulate it, to relax rather than to fortify. It is a movement, this is my emphasis, it is a movement not so much defined by its end as by its starting point, away from, rather than towards, something definite. our point of departure is more real to us than our destination. In the words, releasing energy rather than accumulating it, one is at no pains, although the word is not there, in recognizing the idea of parasitism that was illustrated by Charles Peguy and Gilbert Keith Chesterton. The point of the passage, however, is the open character of modern freedom. Freedom being mere openness. Now, that's a funny thing that in common parlance, openness should have become a positive quality. We praise people who are open and blame those who are not. Now, being open is not always that positive. If the door of an apartment is left ajar, it is better for the tenant who has forgotten his keys, but also a boon for the burglar who won't have to break in. As for the most open of all human beings, well, this is the Japanese samurai who has just committed suicide by ripping up his belly, thereby performing on himself the honorable seppuku, vulgarly known as harakiri. He's open. This kind of freedom knows from where it is taking its bearings, but not what it is driving at. The trouble with this conception is that we are thereby losing the capacity for action, since action requires an aim, something that we endeavor to get. Where freedom is an aim in itself, shorn from the good, no action, properly speaking, is possible. Hence, in our present-day societies, the presence of a strong, all-pervading tendency to replace action with activity. In the political realm, governing with managing. Second question, freedom from what exactly? Our first experience of life is an experience of non-freedom, of radical dependence. We are dependent on a great deal of factors. First of all, we were begotten by parents who could hardly ask for our permission, and thrown into this world in a state of total inability to shift for ourselves, so that we badly needed the care of the older generations. If we perform a dollying out of sorts, we will see that our life hails back ultimately to Darwin's warm little pond. Furthermore, that the atoms in our bodies were made in the furnace at the beginning of the universe. Now, there are two kinds of dependence that we should carefully keep apart from each other. Some of these compelling forces influence us after we have been brought into being and are already there. Some, on the other hand, simply made us what we are. Drawing a line between those two kinds is not easy, for there is a gray zone in which some molding takes place. For instance, language is something that we have not chosen. We were taught to speak this or that definite language by our social environment and first by its nearest dimension, our parents. It is not merely something we put on like a garment. It is a necessary tunic that gave our thought, our cast of mind, a definite twist. As for things that are easier to tell apart from each other, there are the mores of the society into which we were born and in which we have to live. And there are the laws of nature. The former, social regulations, exert a pressure on us. The latter, the laws of nature, simply describe what is. Moreover, they make our action possible in the first place by telling us how we shall have to act if we want our action to be efficient. Natura nisi parendo vincitur, repeated the old Francis Bacon. We can vanquish nature only if we begin with obeying it, or her. If we want to do some swimming, we will have to possess some practical knowledge about Archimedes' principle, for instance. It is a common ploy of social domination to let social constructions be mistaken for natural phenomena. The enterprise of deconstruction is on this point perfectly legitimate. But it must stop at the laws of nature. And this is not always the case. I pointed out an example in Michel Foucault, in my last book by mine that was translated into English. In an interview given by the French philosopher and historian, I could run to the ground an interesting lumping together of social laws and natural laws, which he mentions in the same breath and puts on the same level as the butt of attacks against domination. Once we put artificial constructions out of court and remain with our bare dependence on nature, there remains an ultimate question, namely, whether this dependence is the flip side of a benevolent will that draws us upwards towards higher things or not. In other words, whether nature is the nickname of creation or not. This is what John Henry Newman assumed. We are from our birth. Where is that? I'm awfully sorry. I forgot to put the short sentence on the handout. Well, let me read it. Not too quickly. We are, from our birth, dependent creatures. Utterly dependent. Dependent immediately on man. And that visible dependence reminds us forcibly of our truer and fuller dependence upon God. The Englishman, who was still a member of the Church of England when he pronounced his sermon, chimes in with the German Lutheran Schleiermacher, whose work you probably never heard of. For the latter gave a definition of religion that was to become famous as the feeling of absolute dependence. But now, the question is, can we still see in nature a creation brought into being by a benevolent God, i.e. by a rational being with whom we can enter into a dialogue? That is the question. Freedom can have a meaning if it consists of a free access to our good, which presupposes that our existence should be able to be qualified as good. At the beginning of this lecture, I alluded to the ancient conception of the free fall as being an endeavor on the side of heavy bodies to get to the abode which is for them the good they can get. No, it has its counterpart in the way in which the same thinkers thought of the property of the light bodies to soar upwards. Such a view underlies Augustine's famous doctrine of love as being some sort of weight that drives us towards the goal we look for. Amor meus pondus meum. My love is what brings me, in this case, upwards. Gregory of Nyssa, a contemporary of Augustine, by the way, has the rather weird image of the bubble. He doesn't mean the kind of bubble we produce with soap suds and a blowpipe. He probably thought of the bubbles that arise in the muddy bottom of a marsh, or if you prefer a more pleasurable image, in a glass of champagne. It runs counter to the imagery of the soul falling into matter. We will be able to read the passage which is written in this, well, highly artificial Greek that, well, had to abide by the rules of rhetorics. But the word bubble is not there. That's a bubble. You could not say pomphorux, black on white. But that's the idea. Plato, Plotinus, the Gnostics spoke of the soul falling from its original heavenly abode and having to linger in the filthy matter of this nether world. What was to be explained is how the souls fell, how they lose their wings. On the other hand, those thinkers seldom spoke of the way in which souls come into being. They rather supposed that they simply were there from the outset, because they are eternal and pre-exist the bodies they will later inhabit. Once the souls are believed in Christianity, once the souls are believed to have been created out of whole cloth, what is to be explained is how they can climb upwards. This motion upwards is their freedom. Very much in keeping with this idea, Charles Péguy spoke of freedom as some sort of unfettering, of loosening the shackles. And he had to coin the bizarre word désentrave, which does not exist in French. My last words will be borrowed from my late English friend Stratford Caldecott. Whereas the modern worldview, according to him, makes us live in a flat universe with no ontological depth, quote, the Christian conception of freedom is larger and fuller than the modern conception, for it includes both vertical and horizontal dimensions. May the present conference help us and our present day world and our present day world to recover the breadth and fullness of liberty. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Professor Broad, for this great presentation. Mm-hmm. Could you elaborate on that last quote, what vertical and horizontal you mentioned might be? And I guess, if a secular came to me and said, well, that's fine that freedom requires an understanding of the good, but how do we determine what the good is? Mm-hmm. Well, what do you say at that cocktail party?
Well, it's obvious that Stratford Caldecott's quotation is meant to be paradoxical, i.e. it's well known that we shifted at some point in the history of thought from a conception according to which the world is small, relatively small, to another conception which supposes that the universe is infinite. And he tried to answer this common view by having us reflect on the fact that the modern worldview is sort of flat. We don't live on a flat earth, which we, in fact, never did since Eratosthenes. The legend according to which people in the Middle Ages imagined that the earth was flat is simply bunk. Okay, we should do away with that. The ancient Greeks knew perfectly well that the earth is round. But, on the other hand, we have at the ontological level a worldview which is desperately flat, i.e. all the possibilities between which we have to choose, and this is what you were alluding to, all the possibilities between which we have to choose are on the same level. It is not better to do this than the contrary of it. And for this reason, he characterized the modern liberty as horizontal, doing away, or having from the outset done away, with the idea according to which there are, well, lower and higher levels of being. How we have to choose between what is, well, in front of us, between the various possibilities that we could bring into actuality. Well, this is the very problem of liberty. But there is a criterion, whether what we choose, if we choose what this way of life or this other way of life, whether this way of life enables us to go on being what we are and going on being better than what we used to be. And this is the perhaps the only criterion. And on this point, we have to observe that the alleged laws, that are contained in the Christian message are deeply in keeping with the laws of nature, with what we call a natural law, in the meaning that epistemologists give to this notion when they say, well, there's the law of gravity or things like that. The reason being that once we admit that being is intrinsically and in the teeth of all appearances a good thing, we'll have to endeavor to get as much being as we can, because by doing so, we'll be getting good things. And well, the basic law, the basic, perhaps the basic criterion I should introduce here in order to answer your query about, well, why we should choose this rather than that, is the ability of a choice to enhance life. Not life as a in the meaning that it took in Nietzsche or in his disciples like George Bernard Shaw. That's not life as justifying itself. That's life as leading towards a greater good. But this presupposes the fundamental equation, or to put it in medieval terms, the basic convertibility of being and good. Whatever is, well, in its true depths, good. And this is a choice that we have to make. If we don't make it, we will disappear in the long run. And for this reason, this is to some extent Hobson's choice.
Thank you. At the outset, you made reference to Spinoza's conception of freedom as freedom from fear. Mm-hmm. I think it was maybe the first or second, maybe it wasn't mm-hmm. on there. But I wonder if we could spend a little bit, or you could spend a little bit more time talking about, first of all, whether you agree that that conception is valid as a definition of freedom, or even as a partial definition of freedom, whether freedom from fear is an effective way of mm-hmm. framing liberty in our era. But also, if you could comment on whether it's desirable to have freedom from fear. Because, after all, isn't it fear which sort of inculcates in the individual the individual's utter dependence on others and on God? Is freedom from fear something desirable?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that would be my second.
Well, that's a tall order once again. Well, You were certainly alluding, when you mentioned freedom from fear, to well-known speech by President Roosevelt that was so wonderfully illustrated by Norman Rockwell. The father tucking his child into his bed and having in his hand a newspaper reporting on the bombings on London during the war, during the last war. Well, freedom from fear. In the sense that Spinoza gave to this idea, and in the sense that was given later on by liberal thinkers and, for instance, by President Roosevelt, this is something I can wholeheartedly approve. That's freedom from oppression. Freedom from the presence of a power that simply wants to submit my liberty and prevent me from reaching my own good on behalf of his own good. That's the, freedom from tyranny. Freedom from tyranny. But there is a fear. There is a fear that has a positive meaning. And here I will quote a well-known distinction made by Augustine. The distinction between timor castus and timor servilis. Timor servilis is the fear of the slave, the fear that the slave feels in front of the stick, the master. Okay, and timor castus is the kind of respect, perhaps could do the job as a word, the respect we have in front of our parents or our in front of people whose moral authority we spontaneously recognize. And in this sense, fear is highly educational. We know that we don't educate with a stick, but we educate by the example, by sitting in front of young people and of older people as well, by the way, examples that they would be proud to imitate. And to that extent, fear is not only an educational principle, but perhaps the very principle of education. I mean, not an educational principle among other ones, but the root of each education, because fear is the first reaction we have in presence of reality. The principle of reality is, to some extent, a principle of fear, something we have not made, something that we have to face, something that we have to cope with. And to this extent, I should say that fear, in fact, has a very positive value.
Thank you, Professor. I wonder whether you might help me clear up a confusion that I have. If and since it's the case that the mainstream Christian position about freedom throughout history, and particularly the Catholic position, has been that the truest freedom is to pursue the good, the freedom to pursue the good.
Mm-hmm.
Why, at the Reformation, when the Reformers want to interpret the doctrine of election by saying what God does is liberates humans from their bondage to sin,
mm-hmm.
and gives them the ability, more or less infallibly, to pursue the good of God, why is the Council of Trent, in response, so insistent in defending what seems to me to be a more
liberal understanding, libertarian understanding of the human will?
Well, I'm not sure to have understood the depth hidden in your question. No, honestly speaking, the trouble, you know, with Reformation is that it brought about almost the contrary of what it wanted to get. It wanted to sort of let human life depend entirely on grace. Grace understood as an outer instance, as an external instance, and not something as something that, works in us from the outside and brings us towards our higher good. And what the Council of Trent had to remind the Christian fold of was probably that, freedom is something that we receive, not something that we can take for granted. This was, in my opinion, in my feeling, something I feel in my bones rather than something I could bring to a conceptual, clear-cut a formula, freedom as a gift of God, but as a gift that is not an external instance. This might be the core meaning of what they were trying to get. But I'm not sure I have understood your question adequately. And perhaps we'd have to discuss that afterwards. Yeah?
Please help me in thanking Professor Newman.